Welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my co-host, minister, and friend, Chino Ross, pastor and the voice of the Understanding Scripture and Truth by Chino D. Ross YouTube channel. Chino, it's good to be back and to talk about tall tales. I know that I've probably mentioned these two stories before somewhere on the podcast, but when you get old like me, you start repeating the same stories and everybody looks at you and laughs. But I remember sitting in a service and minister comes out on the platform. I know him. I know the family. I'm deeply involved with the entire situation. And he comes and tells this crazy story about this situation that is, I'm not going to go into details in the situation, but he over-spiritualizes it. I'll say it like that. And it's a battle between good, the forces of good, the forces of evil, the angels, the demons, all this. And he sits there and he tells a story, and suddenly I'm like, wait a minute, I know what he's talking about. That's nothing like what just happened. I was there. I know the whole story. And I know I've told this too, but my best friend, my cousin, I miss him to death. He died during COVID, of COVID. But he, last time he set foot in a church, he sat and he watched somebody stand up and give their testimony about how the mighty powers of God came down during the rapids and they were near death. The raging waters was coming to get them, and suddenly this miracle happened and the waters calmed. And I can't remember how he told the whole story, but he said, John, I was there. I was the one who saved the entire crew. And my cousin was a built guy. He said, I worked like crazy with that paddle to get these guys to safety, and they had chosen the wrong path. They had done a few things wrong. And he said, I'm the one that saved everybody. Yes, maybe God saved them through me, but that's not how that happened. And when he said it, I was in the cult. I didn't really think much about it. But after he's died, after I've had time to reflect on all of this, I've come to realize that that happens probably more often than not in all of the movements that have spun off of this revival-themed ministry. They want to find something spiritual to vindicate whatever it is that they're saying or doing, and often it's just simply not true.
Yeah, John, and so that's our topic that we want to camp out on today, what I would call the lack of integrity and honesty, you know, in the pulpit, or we could call it the dishonesty and arrogance in Christian ministers and Christian ministry today. As a public speaker, you need to be able and willing to tell the truth. And how much more as a Christian speaker should you be able and willing to tell the truth? And when I mention dishonesty in the pulpit, I'm not talking about our dishonesty in general in the ministry. I'm not talking about stealing from the church funds, although we know things like that happen all the time. I'm not talking about the minister living a double life, although that happens all the time. I'm not talking about false doctrine, because, you know, doctrinal points they're open for discussion and open for debate. So I'm not saying that they are necessarily dishonest in that area, but in the very area you talked about when you introduced this by using the phrase tall tales, there's just so much of that that has pervaded the Pentecostal charismatic church history for decades and decades. And because they are so thirsty for supernatural type events, because they're so dependent on that, I'm sure that they're probably guilty of the tall tales more than their non-charismatic brethren, because the non-charismatic churches aren't trying to tell us, for the most part, any big stories of great miracles or, you know, claims of faith or events like that have happened in their life. So they don't need to tell the tall tales. And because my background is with Hobart Freeman and Faith Assembly, you know, that's the perspective and the point of view and the historical reference that I will be talking from. So I'm really talking about, yeah, the stories that they tell, the stories that they tell in the pulpit, part of the message, their own stories, things that have happened in their own life, and probably even more frequent than that was when I heard Hobart Freeman repeat the stories that others had told him. And I was guilty of the same thing myself as a young minister, because I had heard what Hobart said. So if he said that Branham accurately predicted the earthquake in Alaska and predicted that California was going to fall into the ocean and sharks would be swimming in the streets of San Francisco, you know, when he said that John G. Lake had, you know, 100,000 confirmed healings over a 5-year period in his church in the Northwest, all of these things, the stories and visions beyond the veil, the little book published by Baker, the stories told by Mel Torrey in Like a Mighty Wind, stories from Branham and Oral Roberts and T.L. Osborne and Jack Coe and A.A. Allen and Lillian Yeomans and F.F. Bosworth and Smith Wigglesworth and all of these historical figures. In the early years of my introduction to all of this, which would have been my late teens, from 17 through my early 20s, those were the stories that I heard. And we all heard them. If you were under Hobart Freeman's ministry, and if you were under the teaching at Faith Assembly, you heard those stories. And because I was so young, beginning in all this at age 17, I can say I somewhat grew up on it, because I heard these stories more than once. And so when I entered the ministry as a young man in my early 20s, I just told my congregation the same stories. You know, yeah, God will heal. Don't you know that William Branham? Don't you know that this? Don't you know that that? And, you know, I just assumed all those stories were true and accurate. And how wrong I was to repeat those, not having verified anything at all. Of course, I am so young. You know, I give myself a break when I look back on it. Still guilty. I mean, if you did it, you did it. But I still give myself a break when I look back on it and say, you know, I'm listening to a guy in his 50s with an earned doctor's degree in theology, someone who had taught in college and graduate level areas, someone who was, you know, at that time, what, 3 times my age. You know, he should, if anyone should have known better, it should have been him. He should have verified those stories that he was repeating. I don't think, John, that it ever even crossed his mind. We know from what we did a few weeks ago in looking at the Voice of Healing magazine back in 1966, when Hobart Freeman went down to the Deliverance School. It was in some of those very 1966 magazines, and you have them on your website, where that story of John G. Lake and the 100,000 confirmed healings is written up. So Hobart went down there. He saw that. He talked to Gordon Lindsay, who was alive at that time. Kenneth Hagin was there. W.V. Grant was there. The prophetess Anna Schrader. And he heard all these stories. And what did he do? He walked away from that meeting believing 100% everything that he heard. Well, now, looking back, that's extremely gullible to ever do that. And with the history that you have put online for the last several years of the dubious nature of these stories and dubious character of these ministers, I think people are almost to the point today they don't believe any of it. And I'm hesitant to say I don't believe any of it, but I would say I can't believe, I mean, as a reasonable human being, I can't simply believe something because you told me and someone told you and someone told them and someone told them. I mean, come on, we're adult American citizens. We know better than that. Don't believe everything you see on TV. Don't believe everything that comes out of a preacher's mouth. I, as much as the next person, would love to know that the dead were raised in Indonesia and that they walked on water and demons were cast out. I would love for all of that to be true, you know, but the sad fact is I don't know whether much of it, if any of it was true, and what is true. We just got to have some type of verification of it. It's just when you come into this faith area to even seek any type of proof or verification, you are immediately ostracized as a doubter and an unbeliever. And in my heart of hearts, that's not my intention or goal at all. I want to believe the story you're telling me. You raised someone from the dead. I want to believe that. I'm glad that someone who's dead is now resurrected and healed. But I got to have more than your word. And if we didn't have so many charlatans, we probably wouldn't be so skeptical today. You know, it's the increase in dishonesty and arrogance and the presence of so many charlatans that have simply made us all very weary of those stories. So I know early on, I began to sour. That would be the word I would use. I would say I began to sour on Dr. Freeman's stories. I had time to hear more tapes, more messages. And as those are put out, and you know how this works, John, then I'm able to compare what I'm hearing on this new message with that same story. I remember it being told earlier. And it's so interesting, these ministers, they're so desperate to have their messages recorded and broadly distributed out there. And that's wonderful. But when you do that, we have a permanent record of what you said. It's one thing to, you know, tell a story in a private conversation, retell it later in another private conversation, and completely change all the details, and no one can prove what you said originally with what you said later on. But thankfully, to this day, people who are still in support of Hobart Freeman's ministry have made sure that they are getting all of his messages out there. And so they're out there for the public to view and listen to. And all you got to do is go back and compare an earlier one with what he has said in the same story in a later message.
I'm not a fan of quoting this person, and I won't even give his name, but there is a book named Mein Kampf, which if you know who wrote that, you know who I'm talking about. But in that book, he says something to the effect that if you tell a lie long enough and big enough and colossal enough, nobody in their right mind is going to challenge you because they'll think nobody in their right mind would even say something so absurd. And it is the way that you tell a big lie, basically. That's what the book is describing. And the book is propaganda. I'm not recommending anybody read the book, but that one element of that book is actually true. And you mentioned the Voice of Healing magazines. I also recommend, if you've been impacted by this type of movement, or if you're in it and you want to see just how absurd it could be, go back and read The Voice of Healing. You've got everything from the boy who can see through a plastic eyeball to disclaimers that they have lied about certain things. And one of the biggest ones was a pretty big lie. And the reason I referenced the Mein Kampf book, this was exactly an example of this. Branham started claiming in the revivals, as all of these men are joining in with it, that he had healed Florence Nightingale. And, you know, who's going to question this? He also claimed that he had healed King George. Who's going to question this, right? The Florence Nightingale got really funny because it got blown out of proportion. He started claiming that he had healed Florence Nightingale and that there was a sickness that was so drastically just consuming her body that she had went down to absolutely nothing. And the interesting part is I'm 99.9% certain that he was distributing a photograph that was of Holocaust survivors because it was that type of photograph. I mean, you could tell this person had just been starved. And he started distributing it. He even talks about it. You know, you can get the photograph. It's on the tables. We healed Florence Nightingale. And then come to find out, there's no way he could have possibly done this. And people started asking the question, wait a minute, how did you, there's no way you did this, man. And so he started changing the story to the daughter or granddaughter of Florence Nightingale. And that's good. You know, you tell a lie enough, you tell a lie big enough, people are going to believe it until somebody scratches their head and, you know, she never got married. She never had any children. How did he heal the granddaughter of Florence Nightingale if she never had a child? And eventually, I can't remember what issue it is in, but there is an issue of Voice of Healing where they had to backtrack it because so many people knew that this was a lie. But that's the type of movement that this was. They were telling just the crazy, most outlandish things. And if you tell it big enough, if you broadcast it, if you have a publication that can print and distribute it far and wide enough, people are going to believe it. And then when they don't believe it, you just change the story a little bit. Oh, it wasn't her. It was her granddaughter. And wait a minute. She didn't have a granddaughter. But that's the point I'm trying to make. This movement was built on such fiction that when people leave it, they question everything. They question, okay, the stories weren't real. Well, what about the Bible? They've been talking about the Bible, and they keep telling that their fascinating stories are just like the Bible stories. Well, I'm just going to question everything. And people do this, and I'm going to be honest, I don't blame them. Because I went through some of the same things, man. If you're lying to me about everything, what parts can I believe that you're saying that's true? And why would I believe that what you're saying is true? So you really have to take a step back and take everything that is said in the revival meetings with a grain of salt, because it's an indoctrinated theme that if you over-exaggerate something into the spiritual, it's a holy thing, whether it's true or not. And people have gotten so accustomed to it that even if it's not true, many people know that it's not. They sit there and think, well, it sounds good. It made me think about Jesus when he said that lie. And that's really what's happening here. They have reached the point where they simply don't care.
And it's very difficult to disentangle the spiritual story they're trying to tell through the story from the reality and the scriptures themselves. And I agree. People do question everything, the Bible, everything about it, Christianity in general. And I don't fault them either. I do urge them not to throw out the Bible, but maybe throw out everything else and just lock yourself up with the Bible. As I know you've done in the past, just read the Bible. Whatever it says, you can count on. Whatever somebody says about it, maybe, maybe not. You know, you just have to you just have to figure that out on your own. And the more stories these people tell, the more that speaker has to remember. And that became a problem with Dr. Freeman. The more stories you tell, the more that you've got to remember all these stories you told in the past and make sure you tell them the same way that you told them in the past. You know, I would recommend spend more time on the text of scripture, and then you'll have less time left to tell stories, and then you won't have to worry about it. If they would just preach more of the Bible and not tell us these tall tales, either from their life or the ones they've heard from others, you have very little to worry about. Then you only have the text of scripture that you're trying to deal with. And yeah, tall tales, the bigger the story you're telling, the more you have to live up to. You know, I don't know why they just want bigger and bigger and bigger stories, because I think it just attracts a bigger audience. There is a story, I did not take the time to run it down, and we could play the clip. We have other ones we're going to play here today anyway. But in conjunction with Hobart having gone down there to Dallas in 1966 to this first deliverance seminar that Gordon Lindsay was sponsoring, they're going to teach you how to cast out devils. Remember, we talked about that. They're going to teach you how to cast out devils, teach you how to prophesy, you know, teach you how to speak in tongues, teach you how to do all these things. I hear the craziest story, Sean, that somebody said, yeah, I was wondering about speaking in tongues because I went to a class and they gave a class on how to speak in tongues. There's no such thing as that in the Bible. People spoke in tongues in the New Testament. There were no classes on it. They were filled with the Holy Spirit, and then the Spirit gave them utterance, and they spoke the language. There's no way to go to a class. But anyway, I remember a story Hobart told that came out of this Anna Schrader prophecy that he had been given, this end time message of faith, whatever that is. And he was going to minister to God's people in the prisons of denominationalism. And somewhere in that context, either Hobart Freeman himself had this vision. It's a little fuzzy in my mind, so I will be honest and say it's fuzzy in my mind whether he said he had the vision or one of those other people who are praying and prophesying over him had the vision. But I remember the details of it because they're pretty striking, that he was in an auditorium with 5,000 people. He was the speaker, 5,000 people, and they were all in plush, the people were sitting in plush red velvet seats. You know, why is it that all of these visions, why doesn't the person have a vision that God sent them to go speak to 5 people or 3 people or 10 people? No one ever has a vision. No one ever has a dream that God called me to go speak to 10 people. It's always something grandiose. 5,000 people. And how is it, rather than, you know, 5,000 people sitting on a hillside like they did in Jesus' ministry, you're in an auditorium and they're all in red velvet seats? I mean, when you try to kind of dissect the ingredients of the vision or the dream, I don't know about you, but it just, you know, it just sends me immediately to begin to wonder and question. I think when you're new in it all, when you are susceptible to this type of stuff, you don't have any critical thinking skills. And I think that's the whole point. People in their late teens and early 20s are ripe for this kind of ministry and minister and message. Then the stories need to be big, because that's what is attractive. You want there to be 5,000 people, not 5. And you want them to be in plush red velvet seats, because that just sounds so memorable. But when you get older in life and in your Christian walk, you go, now, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. That just something about that sounds, it just sounds hokey, that they're in some grand theater in that type of setting. But of course, the minister wants to cast himself as an important, prominent figure up front with all of these followers. I would be much more quick to believe someone said, well, God gave me a vision and he was going to send me to wherever, and there were 11 people there that I was going to speak to. Because, you know, what do you get out of 11 people? No big deal. I'm much more likely to believe that than these grandiose things. So I want to tell, I'm just going to repeat a story of Freeman's that I have told before to show you how I went from, first of all, just thinking, wow, God's in total control, and God just totally takes care of all your financial needs, to a few years later thinking, now, wait a minute, let me go through the actual details of the story that I've heard many, many times on Dr. Freeman's tapes, because it happened allegedly in the summer of 1966. So for the next 18 years, he's able to tell this same story from 66 till his death in 84. So you get to hear it literally several dozen times. And this is a type of story that I would say probably involves not telling the whole story. There are probably parts of it that are accurate, and I will tell you what I think is accurate, and I have no way to prove this. Hobart Freeman's dead and gone. His wife June's dead and gone. But I'll tell the story, and I'll let them discern and judge for themselves. But I think it's a type of story where you're only telling the part that you want to tell, and the details that you have left out, which are very specific details that you have left out, have been left out intentionally. And I think by leaving them out, you create just an impression that people walk away with in their mind, and it is simply not true. And it concerns Hobart's trip to Israel in 1966. So he's told this story, as I said, dozens of times, sometimes in a more complete fashion. Sometimes he'll just say, you know, when I claimed the money to go to Israel in 1966, and he might not say any more about it. But when he tells it on a message and gives the details, then here's what we have. He went with a guy named Larry Hammond. And guess what? If you go back and look at the Voice of Healing magazine from that deliverance seminar in June of 1966, one of the speakers was Larry Hammond. So that's where he met Larry Hammond. I would not have known otherwise. How did you ever come across Larry Hammond? That's how he came across him. So I'm putting these pieces together in my own mind. They're either true or not true. That in meeting Larry Hammond in June of 1966, Larry Hammond was probably going to go to Israel that summer and told Hobart, Dr. Freeman, you know, do you want to go? You ought to go with me. And Hobart decided he wanted to go. So this part he has told on tape. So all of this part is 100% true. So he didn't have the money. He's just rattling around in his living room in Claypool with a little tiny group of people. So he claimed the money. $1,400. You know, I wish you could go anywhere for $1,400 today, but here's a flight to Israel. Here's the whole trip, 1966, the summer, for $1,400. He had half the money, $700. He had half the money. He tells this before he left Claypool, but he didn't have the balance. He went on to New York City, and as he always has told this tale, 45 minutes before the plane left New York City, an anonymous person gave him the money for the balance of the trip. So, you know, he just tells it like, you know, it's all miraculous. I claimed the $1,400 in Claypool, didn't have it, but before I left home, I had half the money. But, you know, you don't wait. You just take a step of faith. And he told this story, and so everyone tried to do the same thing. Everyone tried to take vacations and travel places with no money or with part of the money, claiming that God would give them the rest of it because he did it for Hobart. And I believe that for the first few years, because you don't even sit down. The point is, John, we're not trained to think that that minister might be misleading us. You know, that never crossed my mind that minister, either intentionally or unintentionally, might be misleading me. Never entered my mind. Now, you know, you and I are quite a bit different. I'll listen to any sermon, but I'm really listening. I don't take anything anybody says. I'm listening, say, does that make sense to me? And I did not know. I should have been suspicious of the story. And all these other people who went on trips and got stranded and then wondered why it didn't work. And then they talked to Hobart and he said, well, you just didn't have faith. You know, the fault was always on the person, rather than saying, that's not the way you take trips. You budget how much is a trip going to cost. You make sure you have the money before you go on the trip. That's how Jesus said people build buildings. You first of all decide, do you have sufficient funds to complete the building? Otherwise, you get halfway through and you're seen to be a fool. Jesus actually does say that in the Gospels, by the way. You need to budget and make sure you have enough money. And so I look at this story, John, and I see Hobart Freeman at the airport. I think it was JFK in New York City. He's needing another $700 to make this trip. And someone came up and anonymously gave him the money. Here's what I need to know. Here's what I need to know. The way you have told the story, it has been a supernatural event that God just supplied the money. So I need to know, did God rain money down out of heaven for you? Probably not. Okay, and Hobart would not say that. Then here's the other thing I need to know. If you mean this was a supernatural miracle, then here's how that had to have occurred. There is a person sitting on a bench in the airport somewhere that you've never seen, doesn't know you, and you don't know them. And you're just standing there, not having told a soul of your need. And you need $700. And a person who is a complete stranger has had the Lord tell them, you see the guy over there at the ticket counter? He needs $700. He's a child of mine. He's trying to get to Israel and he doesn't have but half the money. I want you to go and give him $700. Had that happened, that's a miracle, you know, and that's wonderful. I don't think that happened because he never told the story that way. He simply said someone came up to him and said an anonymous donor wants to pay for the balance of your trip. The person who probably came up to him was Larry Hammond because he was the minister. He was the recognized one. He was going on the trip. The anonymous donor was probably either Larry or someone else traveling in that same group because it was a group of tourists going to Israel. And the way they knew that there was a need is Hobart had told everyone, I don't have the money, but I've claimed it by faith and God is going to provide. So there is a great illustration, at least in my mind, it is a perfect illustration of how a minister can tell a story. I claimed the money. I had half of it, went to New York City. God provided the rest of it there. When I don't know that I would say God provided it. If you mean by that people knew in the group that I needed the money and they were willing to give me the money, and you want to say that God is doing that, I'm okay with that, but I just need the details. We are left with that story in such a context where we are expected to believe that it is some kind of supernatural miracle. And as I said, the only way for it to be that, apart from God making money in heaven and sending it down, is to do what I said with the guy over on the bench. And because Hobart didn't tell the story, John, faithfully, accurately, with transparency, he misled hundreds of other people to go on honeymoons, to make trips, to plan to go see relatives, to even drive to hear him at the Glory Barn when they didn't have enough money to get back home. And they're all doing that on the basis of this story that he told. And ministers don't need to do that. Ministers need to be transparent and honest and just tell the truth.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started? Or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. You know, if I was a religious con man, which I'm not, if I was, I would want to do the same exact thing. I would want to tell the con of somebody, by God's grace, gave me this large sum of money, and I was able to do the thing for free that I would have otherwise had to pay for. Because if you go back and you listen to any recording of any of the con artists that do this, somebody always gives them the money. And the funny part is, you start telling the story of how you need the money, how God will provide it anyway. You do use the name and claim it, prosperity themes that emerged in the latter rain and beyond. And you say, I really have a need, but God's going to supply it. Well, some rich dude's going to supply it for you. All you got to do is keep saying it over and over, and finally God will provide, but usually it's through the listeners of somebody who has heard what you have said. So this, for me, it's, if I were a con man, this would be my favorite con, because there is no way really to get caught. How do you prove God didn't do it if the guy who's rich gave you all of this money? And from the, you know, from a ethical standpoint, you really didn't do anything wrong. You just started begging. And in the end, what it comes out to be is, instead of a minister, you're a beggar. And once I made that connection, I'm like, wait a minute. Look, go down the line of all the prosperity gospel preachers and find out just the sheer number of them that do this. It's almost every one. They will always say, I have a need, but God's going to supply it. And sure enough, somebody's going to give it, or a group of people are going to give it. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy is what it is. But in the end, they're begging instead of preaching.
We're going to play a clip here just a minute to prove that very thing. The long-term damage, John, is when Hobart would tell these stories that I claimed a Lincoln, I claimed a Cadillac, and God provided it. He's almost trying to put himself down on the level of the people, or the people up with him, saying that whatever I do, you can do. And it did not enter the people's minds that the reason he could claim a Cadillac, claim a home, claim a Lincoln, and say it in public was because he had enough of a following, as you just said, that if he puts his needs out there, begs enough, then people will contribute. Even if he doesn't announce it, even if he doesn't announce, I've claimed a Cadillac, even if he doesn't tell us the story until after it happened, and now he's got the Cadillac, and now he says, I didn't have one, but I claimed it, and God brought in the money. It doesn't matter the order in which you told the story. You still have the following to bring you that money. You have enough people. And we out in the congregation, we don't have a following. We don't have people. That's why it doesn't work for the rank and file church member the way it does for the minister. And the bigger the ministry, the bigger the items you can say you claimed. Hobart couldn't say he claimed a jet, but Kenneth Copeland could, or Joyce Myers could, or Andrew Womack could. You know, if you've got a big, big following, you can claim big items because you have people that will supply the need. And the poor old rank and file member out there in the church hearing, well, Brother Freeman claimed a Cadillac. You know, I want to drive a nice Olds 98 and get out of this VW bus that I'm driving. And they go and claim it and go around confessing it. And of course, they don't get anything because they don't have the following. And I just marvel, John, over the fact that Hobart couldn't see that himself. You know, to me, it speaks to his lack of integrity as a Christian, as a man, as a minister. I don't know any other way to explain it. As a minister, you should be able to tell, unless the man on the bench that you've never seen gave you the money, you know that money, M-O-N-E-Y, those dollar bills, you know where it came from. It came from faithful listeners of yours. And if you want to say God brought it in, that's okay, but give us the details. Say, the Lord blessed me with this through these, you know, 10,000 people I have buying my tapes and listening to my message. And then the rest of us scratch our head and go, oh, well, I don't have 10,000 followers, so I can't do that. So we're going to play a very small clip just to prove exactly what you just said, how all a minister's got to do is mention his need. And if you got a big enough following, people will chip in, and all of a sudden you don't have a need anymore. Your need's met. This is on a message entitled Christian Liberty. It was done way back in the mid-1970s in the Glory Barn. Dr. Freeman was teaching on the book of Acts. So he had a message that covered somehow Acts chapters 14, 15, and 16 in one message called Christian Liberty. And believe it or not, it's at the very beginning. How do you even start your teaching? You got three chapters you're going to cover, and at the 5 minute, 41 second mark, he's already into his storytelling. So at 5 minutes, 41 seconds through 6 minutes and 4 seconds.
And I remember just a couple of days ago, we claimed a house over here on the lake, and we're trading the present house on it. That is, we're trading it in, not on that house. It's a long story, and we've taken a step of faith. We don't have all the money, but I've already paid $2,000 down. The realtor can't get over the fact that we're paying cash for it and already claiming it, you know, by faith.
So there's really not much for me to comment on that. But, I mean, he says, as everyone just heard, he said, just a couple of days ago, we claimed a home over there on the lake. And that's the home he ended up living in. Just a few days ago, we claimed it. And we're trading the present house on it. We've taken a step by faith. I'm quoting part of this because I have it written down. We don't have all the money. Hint, hint. And he never said that he was a beggar. He always said everybody else begged, but we don't tell anybody our needs but God. Okay, there you go. You have it on this message. We've taken a step by faith. We don't have all the money, but I've already paid $2,000 down. The realtor can't believe we're paying cash for it, but we've already been claiming it by faith. On other tapes, you find out that he ended up getting that house. He paid $40,000 for it. That was a house on Shoe Lake that he ended up dying in that house, you know, 10 years later. But they paid $40,000 for it. The way I know this is by listening to Dr. Freeman's tapes. He spent $40,000 remodeling it. So back in the day, that was a, you know, a nice little place. You got an $80,000 house in the mid-1970s sitting right on the shore of Shoe Lake. That's a pretty good deal. So that speaks to what you just said a few minutes ago, John, that, yeah, ministers, they're beggars. All they have to do is mention what the need is. Mention that you don't have the money. Mention this is how much you put down. And, you know, people can pull out their own calculator and say, well, let's see, you know, if we chip in this much, then Brother Freeman will have enough to buy the home. Am I saying that he intentionally did that to get people to give? No, I don't know people's mind. I don't know their hearts. Maybe he was just so naive and literally so wrapped up in God will do anything. All you got to do is claim it. I mean, it's possible that he was so wrapped up in that. I mean, I'm really giving him the benefit of the doubt here, but it's possible. So wrapped up in this faith and how God's going to supply all of my needs that when he said that, he's doing it out of genuine enthusiasm and excitement, never connecting the dots in his own mind. Oh, if I say this, that tells them and then they'll give me money. I mean, that's being as generous as I can possibly be. So he either did it like that under those conditions, or he did it under more nefarious, worse conditions where he knew if he said it, people are going to give. I think on Dr. Freeman's earlier tapes, he did tend to be more honest and transparent. I just think as you grow and expand and your influence becomes greater, you have a bigger following. I think from what I have seen with ministers and ministries is they become less transparent and less honest as time goes on. At least I think that's the case with most ministers. And so here's a topic we've talked about earlier. We're not going to beat a dead horse, but just to show that Hobart earlier in his ministry on the recorded messages, which are available to the public, was more transparent and was more honest when he discussed his struggle over wearing or not wearing neckties. We talked about this. We talked about all the dress codes where Faith Assembly ended up. But he talks on many of the messages, his struggle over wearing neckties. I didn't know what he was talking about because I didn't come from any background where there would be a struggle. But because he came out of the Old Order Brethren Church, a group that did not believe that men, they could wear a sport coat, a suit coat, but not a necktie. And the argument was a necktie is purely decoration, doesn't hold anything up like your belt holds your pants up. It's just there to make you look pretty. And of course, they're not in favor of any of that. So neckties are ruled out. And so Hobart would preach without a necktie, even after becoming charismatic. And he honestly talks about his struggles. Well, he prayed over it and prayed over it, and God finally showed him. I don't think that's anything you really need to pray over. But anyway, he did, and God showed him that it's okay to wear a necktie. And do you know what his response, John, was always? He would say this, a famous statement. Are you ready for it? I've read Galatians. Anytime someone came up to him and tried to bind him by saying, you can't wear a necktie, he'd say, I've read Galatians, and we know it's a book on Christian freedom. Paul says, stand fast in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again in the yoke of bondage. He said, I've read Galatians, I'm free. And you know, by the end of his life, he was telling people, women couldn't wear pants. Women couldn't carry prostitute purses. No one could wear painter's pants. No one could wear t-shirts with a name on them. No one could wear sodomite shoes. It's like he reverted back to his old days of legalism after telling everyone, I've read Galatians, I'm free. I can wear a necktie or not wear one. It makes no difference. By the end of his life, he had reverted back into all of that bondage that he had come out of as far as clothing is concerned. But with the time we have left, John, I've got one really important story I want to look at with regard to how Hobart told the truth earlier in his life. He was more transparent. He was happier. He was freer. He wasn't as sick as he was at the end of his life. And so it concerns this. He had a book in print entitled How to Know God's Will. Really important, famous little book. I don't know, 50, 60, 70 pages. How to Know God's Will. And, you know, that's every Christian's desire. Every believer wants to know, what is God's will for my life? It's an interesting book. It's I don't know that people that followed Hobart then and don't follow him now have even thought back on that particular book, How to Know God's Will, and wondered about the scripturalness, you know, the biblical soundness of that book. Because if you look on Dr. Freeman's tape list, he has all of these messages on how to discern the voice of the Spirit, three steps to divine guidance. Always talked about how he walks knowing God's will 100% of the time. And the rest of us, you know, we don't know God's will 100% of the time, but Hobart always did. Or acted like I walk in God's will. And here's how you can know God's will if you buy my book and read these chapters. And so when you read the chapters, he has all of these, I won't say steps, I'll just say they were different methods by which a Christian could know God's will. And so he would, you know, list things like a dream. God may give you a dream, and that will show you what he wants you to do, or he may give you a vision, or there may be a word of knowledge, or there may be a prophecy. He just had just a long list of methods, ways by which a Christian could know God's will, because we all want to know God's will. Should I buy a business? Should I move to this location? You know, what should I do about this situation? And when I think back on that and I look at that list of ways that are in the Bible, some people did discern, they found out God's will because they had a dream or they had a vision, or Agabus came and spoke a prophecy in the church in Antioch in the end of Acts 11, or, you know, there are a whole variety of ways where people have learned. But Hobart has them all in this book, like, well, if you don't have a dream, then go to the next chapter, and it may be a vision. If you don't get a vision, then go to this. And some of them were the inner impulse or leading of the Holy Spirit. Some of them were the agreement of the Holy Spirit with your own spirit. I mean, when I look back at that, it just seems so complicated. And it seems so similar to going to the underworld and either consulting a Ouija board, and if that doesn't work, tarot cards, if that doesn't work, a crystal ball, if that doesn't work, just go to a spiritualist medium and let them go into a trance, and then maybe they will have a revelation. It's just all of these ways where I think in reality, although there are times when we specifically do know what God's will is, most of the time we're just trusting that if we will delight ourselves in God and love Him, then He will direct our steps. And so many times we look back and it's in hindsight, we see what the will of God was for us. And I'm not discounting that you can't know in advance, but I don't think it's as clear cut as this, you know, cookie cutouts as Dr. Freeman had it. So one of the methods in that book, John, was laying out a fleece, F-L-E-E-C-E. So you're laughing as I'm starting down this path. So you have to go back to the book of Judges, and it's in Judges 6, Gideon laid out a fleece because he wanted to know the will of God, whether he was going to be anointed to go and deliver Israel. And so a fleece was actually a real fleece. You know, it's an animal skin with the hair and everything on it. Ever since that time, you know, it's laying out a fleece could be done in a lot of different ways. You don't have to skin an animal to do it. But whenever Gideon did it, he had to have a fleece. And so he said, Lord, you know, I want to know what your will is. And so I'm going to put you to the test. So I'm going to lay this fleece out. And in the morning, if the fleece is wet from dew and, you know, all the ground around it is dry, then I'll know that this is your will. So he gets up the next morning and sure enough, it's exactly as he had asked. The fleece was wet. The ground was dry around it. But I'm sure Gideon got thinking, well, maybe somebody poured water on that fleece. So I need to reverse how I want God to show me this. So he said in his second prayer, Lord, I want the fleece to be dry and the ground all around it to be wet. When he woke up the next morning, that's exactly the way it was. And, you know, you can see the rationale, because if all of the ground around that fleece was soaking wet with dew, just the fleece touching the ground would have absorbed some of that moisture, and the fleece, at least around the outside of it, it would be wet as well. But it wasn't. So consequently, Gideon knew what the will of God was by laying out a fleece. In Hobart's original edition of How to Know God's Will, guess what he has as one of the methods of discerning the will of God? Laying out a fleece. Now, laying out a fleece might amount to this, John, where you say, Lord, if you want me to go witness to Bob Smith, then when I get in my car, I want every light, stoplight, to be green from my house to his house. And if every light is green, that's laying out a fleece, then I'll know you want me to witness to him. So that was in the early editions of Dr. Freeman's book. We're going to play, I know we don't have a lot of time left, I'll try to hurry up. We're going to play a very brief clip where he talks about having to revise that book, and he's honest. He just says, now, look, you know, in my earlier days, you know, I didn't really understand that. And so I had the fleece in there. I don't believe that scriptural anymore. And the reason that I don't believe it's for today is, he said, I got it directly from God. So here's a small clip. It's on a message entitled, God Reveals Himself in Creation, done in 1973. From 42 minutes and 20 seconds to 43 minutes and 7 seconds, if we can hear that.
Fleeces. Now, I recognize that in the early edition of one of my books, I list the fleece as one of the means of revelation. It is a means of revelation, but God would rather His children use the higher channels or methods of revelation, basically learn to listen to their own spirit and the voice of the Holy Spirit in them. And so in our later editions of that book, we have deleted the section about, we have deleted mentioning the fleece. If you got an old copy, well, we'll give you a new one. Well, we follow the Lord too. We learn as we go along. And if you want to know why I changed that, I got it directly from the Lord. And I mean, I got it directly, friends.
So I want people in the conclusion here today, John, to compare 1973, what we just heard, where Hobart admitted he had to revise that book. And he did it whenever he found out directly, and he says, I mean, I got it directly from the Lord that we aren't to put fleeces out today. When I first heard those messages, then I realized, okay, you can't put out a fleece. At least according to Hobart, fleeces aren't scriptural. That was just something Gideon did. But I always wondered, what do you mean you got it directly? If you heard that clip and that only, how would you interpret that? I would interpret that, I got it directly from the Lord. I would take that as either I heard his voice audibly, or he appeared in the room to me and pointed his finger at me and told me no, and corrected me. That's the way I would take that. Maybe you would take it differently. That's the way that I would take that. In light of what we just heard, let's fast forward 11 years, and we're going to listen to this a little bit longer clip. This is about a minute on a message entitled Freedom from Fear, Part 1, from 43 minutes, 43 seconds to 44 minutes and 41 seconds.
A certain man had a misstatement in his book. Now, this was a charismatic minister, a misstatement. It wasn't any theological error, heresy, false doctrine. It was just not up to where it ought to be under grace. And someone told him that a certain prophet had a revelation on this. So this author contacted the man who was supposed to be a prophet and said, I heard you've got some direct knowledge, a word from the Lord on this. He said, I sure have. And so it was told what was in the book. He said, no, that's for Old Testament. God sometimes will do that for a new Christian or a novice. Now, I'm not going into detail purposely. I'm just saying it was a relatively minor thing. But this person was so sensitive to wanting to please the Lord, he said, all right, I'll take your word for that, that the Lord said that to you. I've got about $12,000 worth of books, and I'm going to destroy them.
So here, John, he has told that story again 11 years later. And let me just say, changing the wording, or actually editing the fleece as an option to know God's will out of the book, he told that story many times on earlier tapes. He told it several times, maybe not many, but I knew. And I had the earlier book, so I knew it had fleece in there. And then when you bought a later edition, you found out he had edited that as a legitimate method for determining God's will. So here we are. This is not long before he died. 1984, Freedom from Fear. And I actually have this whole, that quote, or most of it, written out. And when I heard it, it was really disheartening. You know, hearing Hobart change the stories, reword them. As I said earlier, I just really soured on the man. But here's what he said, because you don't always, John, have the opportunity to hear this, you know, while you and I are discussing and recording together. Here's what he said. A certain man had a misstatement in his book. This was a charismatic minister, a misstatement. It wasn't any error, heresy, false doctrine. It just wasn't up to where it should have been under grace. And I'm thinking, I wonder who you're talking about, a certain man. And someone told him that a certain prophet had a revelation on this. So the author contacted the man who was supposed to be a prophet. This, by the way, is Kenneth Hagin, because I heard Hobart tell the story earlier and mention he had called Hagin to get his advice. And he said, this is a prophet speaking to Hobart, no, that's for the Old Testament. God will sometimes do that for a new Christian or a novice. Back to Hobart. Now, I'm not going into detail purposely. I'm just saying it was a relatively minor thing, but this person, meaning himself, was so sensitive to wanting to please the Lord that he said, I've got about $12,000 worth of books, and I'm just going to destroy them. So I hope people can see the glaring difference. Early in his ministry, he said, I was wrong in my teaching on fleece, and I went back and edited the book. Later, when he's going to tell the same story that we all know, and we know who he's talking about, he starts it off by saying, a certain man. And he ends it by saying, this man was so sensitive to wanting to be pleasing to the Lord. And he's talking about himself. And that was just very disturbing for me. I knew, Hobart, you're telling a story that you've told many times earlier. You're telling it about yourself, but for some reason, you don't want to name that you are the party. And you don't want to tell us that earlier when you said you got this revelation directly from the Lord, that what directly really meant was you call Kenneth Hagin, who was this so-called prophet, and Kenneth Hagin is the one who told you, and then you went back and edited your book. It's very disturbing to me, John. I hope just this one illustration of this one story of laying out a fleece and how Hobart, not that he changed his position. You and I have said before, we've all changed our position, and you better change it if you were wrong earlier. What is so disturbing is he changed his position, but he tried to distance himself by telling the story in the third person anonymously, as though this certain man wasn't really him.
Well, I hate to say it, but a certain man is going to bring this podcast to a close. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks, John, for having me.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.